you know, jerking off in an auditorium full of dudes. Maybe you're into that, but a lot of people just want to do it. You know, a lot of people want to just sit on their couch and beat their meat.
Radio Drone.
I'm Josh Hadley, and I'm a child of the video store. Cecil Trachtenberg, you are also a child of the video store, correct?
Trachtenberg.
I've never pronounced your name right once. I don't intend to start now.
I'm just saying.
You've been on the show over 100 episodes. Have I ever pronounced it correct once?
No, probably
not.
There
you go.
I'm 12 years old, and what is this?
And Peter Gajic is here as well, and you are a child of the Canadian video store, which is slightly different, but still a video store, right?
Kind of the same thing, yeah. I had my mom and pop stores and my Blockbusters and VHSs and Videomaticas, which and Black Dog videos, some of which are actually still in circulation, which I'm happy about.
Only in Canada would that happen, thanks to, we'll get into that. Tonight we're going to talk about how video, not necessarily the video store, although that plays into this, how video changed movies. But before that, one of the staples of the video store was porn. If you guys want to get some modern porn, not on VHS, but there's still video there, you go to adamandeve.com. There you can kink up your holidays. You use the promo code DROME, D-R-O-M-E, and you will get 50% off of a single item. You will get a free Naughty and Nice kit with a gift for him, a gift for her, and a gift for both of you, and free U.S. shipping, just for using the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. I'm going to be calling this episode I Lost It at the Video Store, based on the new book I Lost It at the Video Store, A Filmmaker's Oral History of a Vanished Era by Tom Rosten. Now, this is less of a book and more of a collection of anecdotes. People like Darren Aronofsky, Luc Besson, Quentin Tarantino, Kevin Smith, John Sayles, people like that, they share their remembrances of how going to the video store actually shaped not only their love of film, but also their love of what they became as a filmmaker. But there's also something I want to read here that shows just how I've never thought of this before, but just how much video in general changed how we make movies as a total. Tim Blake Nelson, an actor and director, has this amazing quote here. In the proliferation of close-ups and in windows now, movies have changed. Since the advent of video, most films are seen on small screens, and so the wide shot, or what Scorsese would call the shot, a real composition that is not just about somebody's face, no longer prevails as part of the film aesthetic. We're so eager to get in there and see a face because we are seeing movies on the same screen in which we're editing the movies, and we don't trust the figure being small in the frame. Whereas when the movie theater was the sole venue in which you were going to see a movie, the wide shot with a figure in the foreground or in the background was just giving you a lot more visual information. I have to reset the impulse to dispense with wide shots when wide shots are very beautiful and, more importantly, they're often quite philosophical, unquote. What he's basically saying is video kind of ruined us, that nowadays filmmakers, they won't take those beautiful full widescreen shots because they knew, especially in the 80s and 90s, those are just going to be cropped down and more people are going to be seeing this on television or on video. So we need to make movies like they're going to be seen on television and video. Is that an accurate way to look at how video kind of inadvertently changed how movies started being made?
I can see that being an accurate representation, at least in terms, obviously, of the things that were going to be straight to video or straight to television, the made-for-TV stuff and the made-for-video store.
I don't even mean that. I mean like how a theatrical movie, they know they're going to get a certain audience in the theater, but they know they're going to get five times that audience when it plays on HBO. So let's shoot the movie as they're going to see it on HBO, and if you see it in the theater, you just happen to get more. That's what I think he was trying to say, is filmmakers started to change how they shot movies, knowing that the bulk of their audience would see it on a small screen.
Which does make sense in a way, but unfortunately for you know, when these movies get remastered, they're obviously not shot in, you know, widescreen, and they don't look as good when they're transferred over and remastered. But I can see that mindset making sense then, because, yeah, the whole video sales thing was pretty important to keep your movie in circulation and knowing who your audience was. So I guess they were doing that just to cut down time of transferring it over to video. The quote, it definitely makes sense in a way. I don't know if I agree with it. I think you should go balls to the wall and put as much effort into your movie as you can and really shoot it exactly how you want to, regardless of how it's going to look on video or what, because, I mean, the ultimate goal should be that the version of the movie that you're putting out is exactly what you had in mind, regardless of the video sales or what. I mean, especially because, you know, times changed, you know, formats changed. We went from just seeing stuff in full frame to a full screen and widescreen, and all those formats changed, and every filmmaker that did stuff to only fit into the mold of a video store or TV release kind of f***ed themselves because, well, times changed.
It did, but it's also frustrating because there's a lot of directors that probably were forced to kind of adhere more to shooting it for the home video market. You know, hey, you know, we've got more people that are going to see it this way. More people are going to go pan and scan. So don't do these really epic wide shots anymore, because it's all going to be cropped 4:3 anyway. I think that it's frustrating and it's annoying. And I wish more directors would kind of stand up and make the film that they want to make, instead of trying to make it for a market that may or may not even watch the movie.
Well, that happened even as late as the early 2000s, when DVD was still a, quote, an unknown variable. Only big, big movies were coming out on DVD. And even in cases, like, there are numerous cases where first DVD release was full frame, even if the movie was widescreen, maybe even on Laserdisc at that point. Look at the problems that The Insider and Last of the Mohicans had from Michael Mann. Michael Mann is one of those filmmakers that has always used the entire widescreen that he's been given. He refused to let The Insider or Last of the Mohicans go out on VHS full frame. So he only released those widescreen. And guess what? They sold like ass, because people were like, they still had that mindset in the early 2000s. No, half the screen's missing. The top and bottom's missing, you know? Paramount was actually mad at Mann for insisting that his movies only be seen widescreen. There was a Paramount executive that was quoted as saying Mann cost them over a million units, over a million VHSs being sold by insisting the film be widescreen. So even into the early 2000s, unfortunately, that idea was prevalent.
One of the funniest things I ever saw, it's showing how pan and scan is just a mess. The movie Multiplicity, where they had multiple Michael Keatons all over the screen. And there were certain scenes where there'd be four Michael Keatons, and there'll be two, like, you know, one basically spaced across the screen. And so there was a big scene where they're arguing, and the one Michael Keaton's arguing with the other, and the pan and scan, it was some of the worst I'd ever seen, because it was like zzz, zzz, zzz.
What was it, a bunch of whip pans?
Yeah, it was a bunch of whip pans going back and forth, where and it was really bad, like digital whip pans. So it had that stuttered, like, dit, 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 across to get to, you know, the other person. And it was hilarious, because it's like, this was a scene that, you know, when you see it in widescreen, it was impressive, because you had, you know, the same actor arguing with himself across the screen, but now that effect is gone because they keep kind of having to zoom back and forth, and you're thinking more about that as opposed to thinking about how really, you know, how well they shot it. Now, the quality of the movie, it wasn't quite as good as they'd hoped, but the experiment I thought worked. Going with the Michael Mann thing, you've got a director who has more than earned his reputation. And then he insists on something.
He uses Michael Mann. Look at The Insider and Last of the Mohicans. He uses every inch of that wide screen, doesn't he?
Yeah. And I mean, and that's why, like, people know his name and they don't know, like, some of these other music video directors that have come up and have become directors.
Marcus Nispel, you should die.
I wouldn't say he should die, but I'm not particularly fond of him. I think that it's irritating and frustrating that you have directors that are probably not getting as much work because they're refusing to adhere to these nonsensical things.
It's Michael Mann. I mean, the guy is going to make the kind of movie that he wants to make, and his movies are very grand scale and very epic and use those epic widescreen shots. So, you know, Last of the Mohicans was maybe screwed over a little bit, but he's still Michael Mann, and he's going to continue being Michael Mann and making exactly the kind of movies that he wants to make. And I'll always respect him for that. And he deserves the recognition that he gets for having having as much, you know, passion for the visuals in his films that he has, especially his stuff from the 80s and the 90s.
Well, now, see, when home video came in, it was such a new thing that people couldn't even fathom the idea of video, of home video, of I get to watch the movie on my TV in my house. Are you nuts? People couldn't fathom this idea to the point where people were watching television. Cable is still very much in its infancy at this point. So people are just watching their movies on television, and they're watching them generally edited. So the idea of being able to watch a movie uncut in your own home, stop it, go back, watch a scene again, etc., was so new, nobody wanted to be the first to do it. Nobody wanted to be the first to put out anything on video because of the fact that they didn't know what the hell to expect. So the first home video label is technically Magnetic Home Video. Guy licensed 20 20th Century Fox films. And we're talking about Patton, Sound of Music, things like that. You know, Star Wars is not out for a few years, things of that nature. These are pretty mainstream films. And he moved over 45,000 units in the first month. And Fox was like, I think we want to redo our deal. And he's like, oh, no, you don't get more money. So Fox started to see this, but they were afraid that video would hurt their television sales. You know, the Monday night movie at the week and whatnot. So then Charles Band comes in with Mita Home Entertainment. And this is where our market starts. Charles Band didn't have access to Patton and the Sound of Music and MASH and things like that. I'm going to read this 1978 Mita box, okay? These are every, not counting those 20th Century Fox, this is every movie available on home video in America, okay? Halloween, The Groove Tube, Slithis, Night of the Living Dead, Tunnel Vision, Laser Blast, Flesh Gordon, Alice in Wonderland, The Porno, Assault on Precinct 13, The Jungle Book, not the Disney version, 20 Years of Rock and Roll, Rod Stewart in Concert, Yes Stars, Rockstar 69 Studio Sessions, a tribute to Billie Holiday, Cheech and Chong Perform, Jimi Hendrix in Concert, some Superman shorts, Shame of the Jungle, Gulliver's Travels, and some classic cartoons of the 1930s. Do you see how that, the Mita Home Entertainment, was geared more towards people like us than, say, something like Patton was? Is it a surprise to you that Mita Home Entertainment titles sold almost five times as much as Magnetic Video titles did?
No, not a surprise at all, because he understood the market better. It was like, hey, here's what the people really want to see, and they were giving it to him.
Yeah, are you going to really go out and spend $80 on Patton or on Assault on Precinct 13?
Well, I think that's great. I mean, they obviously wanted to give people more variety, and it helped out and worked out in their favor because they sold a lot of units. And I think that's awesome that they knew that there was a market for that kind of stuff, because there's always going to be people who want to see more than just, you know, mainstream titles. They're the types of people that go to the video store looking for random stuff like all the ones you listed. So I think that's fantastic.
Then the video store started to crop up. Now, remember, a lot of these things were very expensive. To buy a new video was $80 in 1978 money. So that's like $200 on one movie. And that's ridiculous. A VCR is $4,000 at this point in history, okay? Not every person is going to be able to go out and do this. Getting cable, not even counting HBO or Showtime at this point, just getting basic cable for maybe 30 channels is probably $80 a month. And that's, again, in 1978 to 1980 dollars. So it's very expensive to be a movie fan at this point. Now, you had before this the stuff from the Warren magazines, those little 16-millimeter reels where you'd get like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein edited down into, you know, 18 minutes and whatnot that you could play on a wall. I'm not really counting those. So as the video store starts to crop up, the studios start to see that there's a market for this more than they ever could have imagined. They cannot people like Charles Band, and then you have Wizard Video importing all the weird Italian stuff and whatnot coming in, and the more sleazy stuff like Wizard of Gore, they can't make these fast enough. Keep in mind, $80 in 1978 to 1980, these things are flying off the shelves. So then the video stores get the idea to start renting. Well, the studios don't like this. Studios are like, so you're going to buy the tape from us and then you're going to make $500-$600 off of the $80 you paid us? Uh-uh, we want a cut of this. So at this point, the video store is almost all indie and, you know, trash exploitation cinema. Can you see how the majors holding out actually might have helped video? That if they had, if 20th Century Fox and Paramount and Warner Brothers had actually released all of their stuff, video might not have taken off? Because let's face it, people are going to want Slithis a lot more than they're going to want MASH, aren't they?
It's funny. The companies just continuously shoot themselves in the foot with this kind of stuff. Because at first, they didn't want VHS. And then VHS comes along and it makes them a ton of money. And then they don't want rentals. And then rentals happen and they make them a ton of money. And then DVD comes along and they don't want DVDs. And then DVD makes them a crap ton of money. So it's just like every time there's some new format that comes along, their first instinct is to fight it. And then what happens? They make a crap ton of money. You know, they were all flipping out over Napster and all that. And then what happens? Apple comes along and puts up iTunes and they make billions of dollars. It's like, understand your market and release a product that people will be willing to buy and you will make a lot of money.
No, but see, that's the problem. They didn't understand their product. Sid Sheinberg, the head of Universal at the time of this contra of the 1984 Sony Betamax decision, is quoted as saying, the reason Universal will not get into the home video market is, and I quote here, you should not have the right to pay once and see a movie 100 times. You should have to pay every time you want to watch it, unquote. Their mentality was, F*** you, pay me.
Well, that's what they tried to do with DivX. Now, I'm not talking the codec DivX.
No, I remember the DivX disaster.
Mm-hmm. Like, DivX was basically you would go to a store and you bought, instead of buying a DVD player, you'd buy a DivX player. And then you would buy DivX movies. Now, the other thing that was funny about DivX movies, DVDs came in these nice little plastic slipcases. And DivX came in these little piece of crap cardboard flap, you know, copies, and you would pay less for the DivX movies, but that's because you could only watch them once. And so you'd take it home and you had to hook this device up to your phone line and you put the disc in and it would call a thing and it basically would give you a 24-hour rental for that one particular movie. And then if you put the thing in again, it would call the phone line and it would charge your credit card every time that you wanted this, you know, to watch a movie that you owned.
That's actually a takeoff of something that happened in the VHS era, though. There was a new format that was trying to challenge VHS in the early days. I think it was called U-Matic or something like that, where the tape could not be rewound. You'd have to take it back to the video store and pay them to rewind it with a special rewinder. That's the same concept as DivX, essentially, isn't it? You get to watch it once.
And thankfully, people like didn't go for it. I remember there were people buying it, and I'm like, why are you buying this? Like, don't you? I think that a lot of it was stupidity. Like, they didn't understand that they were buying something, and then they weren't going to be able to continue to use it. They weren't looking at the bigger picture of it. And thankfully, it bombed really hard, and we're not stuck with that now.
I think that's disgusting. It's just showing that people want to, you know, money grub as much as they can. It's I guess it's not enough that people want to see your movie in theaters. It's not enough that they want to buy a copy and own it. No, you got to keep paying to rent a movie and keep paying every time you want to watch it. It just shows the immense amount of greed that certain people have, and that the whole property and rights thing can get a little ridiculous when it comes to some people. Like, when you rent a movie, that should be, you know, it's a rental. Every time you take out a movie, you're paying a little less to be able to rent and watch it. But if you buy one, like, if you actually buy your own copy, that's it. You've spent a little more and you get to keep it. Whereas that whole DivX thing just sounds like complete bullshit. I don't even remember that, and I'm glad that I don't.
I remember seeing the commercials for it. I remember seeing it, like, you know, the demo and in some stores. But yeah, DivX bombed. Christ, Cecil, wasn't that less than a year that actually existed, maybe?
Yeah, wow. I think it made it less than a year. And I mean, that just goes to show that, like, look, you really, you want to, but you're not going to be able to screw the general public. And the thing is, you're telling me that people wouldn't have figured out some kind of workaround?
Oh, yeah. There's always a workaround. Like, I used to, in the VHS era, I got tons of screeners from TV stations and whatnot because I worked in various media sources. What they tried to do for screeners was, it's VHS, so it's magnetic tape, right? They would put a little magnet on the inside of the VHS tape, so as you played it, it would erase the tape so you could only watch it once and not copy it. It was it was real quick before you figured, let's just unscrew this and take out the magnet. You know, it didn't take us long to figure out, just take out the damn magnet. That said, what about when the video store started to come in? Because, like I said, we're all into the exploitation, the horror, the sci-fi, and whatnot. In these early years, mom-and-pop stores were popping up so much that Newsweek did a piece on them, and it was either 1983 or 1984. There were more video stores in America than any other type of store that had popped up in the last 3 years. That, you know, there were other startup type stores, but video stores proliferated to the point where they were like a virus. Every town, you could have a town of, like, you know, 8,000 people, and you'd have 4 mom and pop video stores. This is all pre-Blockbuster taking over and wrecking everything. Video was that popular. So obviously you needed product for a video store, right? The majors were still holding out. They were still dealing with cable. They didn't even like dealing with cable, but that's a whole different subject. So you had the Charles Bands and the Lloyd Kaufmans, and you had all of these the movies that would have been made for the drive-in just 5 years earlier, now being made direct to video. Direct to video was a phenomena that I don't think, if you weren't there, you can understand. If you grew up when you always had Netflix and direct and DTV movies, I don't think people can understand what a phenomena direct to video was.
Well, direct to video really obviously helped a lot of sort of the more lesser known filmmakers like the Lloyd Kaufmans and stuff be able to distribute their product. And I think that was really a great time for, you know, the types of movies that we in particular really love, you know, the exploitation movies and the smaller sci-fi flicks and the smaller action movies. Without that, you know, that boom and directors being able to put those movies out, you know, we wouldn't have guys like Lloyd. We wouldn't be treated to actors like Red Brown and stuff like that. So that really introduced people and helped people see more of these smaller, lesser known genre films.
Yeah, the VHS boom, it really helped the smaller companies, and there are a lot of indie films that probably wouldn't exist today if that didn't happen. It definitely was a good thing that the movie studios were stupid enough to not realize the market and get into it when they could have, because that really just opened the door for things like Empire Pictures and whatnot to really do well, and Canon, and just get out there and make these really fun, entertaining movies that weren't huge budgeted things, and they weren't trying to rip off their audience.
But eventually, the studios always catch on. Then when they catch on, they flood the market. I don't think something like Blockbuster would have taken over as much as it did by the early 90s if they didn't have the studios behind them. If they were just stocking Troma movies and Wizard Video movies and Live Entertainment and Media Home Entertainment, I don't think that would have worked. They were studio back, and I think that changed the dynamic. People like us were going to rent, you know, a Sleepaway Camp movie or a Best of the Best film or whatnot. Most people were going to rent Pritzi's Honor or Sophie's Choice, you know, the new Clint Eastwood movie. In a lot of cases, the studios, when they did catch on, they flooded the market to the point where it became unprofitable. A lot of independent filmmakers have essentially the same horror story about numerous different companies. By 1983 and 1984, you could sell anything on home video. There's a quote by one guy. He said, if you put the right cover on it, I could sell 1,000 units of my bar mitzvah video an hour with the right cover. By the time you got to about 1987, 1988, that was no longer possible, because you had all of the bigger studios gobbling up the smaller distributors and making them subsidiaries. It got to the point where some filmmakers said, you just can't make money at this. That, my movie sold 60,000 units, and yet somehow it didn't make a profit after advertising and packaging. And he's like, having your movie distributed on home video by the late 80s was a death sentence. The studios wrecked the whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you'd go to the mom and pop video stores, you would find a wall of a variety of stuff. You would find all kinds of movies. I mean, I actually there was a book that I wrote the foreword for, where I was talking about how I discovered like my love of bad movies because I was venturing out into the non-mainstream stuff. You'd go to Blockbuster and they have 50 copies of The Matrix, and there's no room for all these little tiny films. I mean, you could go into the aisles and you might find like Turkey Shoot or something, but they'd have like one copy and it would never be in stock. And then they started like, they got in trouble for like editing movies. It just was annoying and it was bad. And really, if they didn't have the support of the studios behind them, they wouldn't have flourished quite as much as they did. But the problem was Blockbuster was kind of like Starbucks. Blockbuster would come into town and next thing you know, there's 50 of them. And all the mom and pop stores start going out of business because they just can't keep up, because the majority of the general public, they're going to go and, hey, I want to see, you know, new hit movie number 10 that just came out on home video. And the little mom and pop shop only has a couple of copies and Blockbuster has 100 of them. They're always going to be able to go there and get the movie that they want to see. And meanwhile, you know, people like us, we want to see the weirdball movies and we can't. There was a West Coast Video near a friend of mine, and we used to go there all the time, and they had just great movies. They had all kinds of really unusual, odd titles, and it wasn't a mom and pop store, but it was still a chain that wasn't quite, you know, Blockbuster. They got bought by Blockbuster, and I remember they took all the unusual oddball movies and threw them in the garbage, and then consequently locked the dumpster so that you wouldn't have any dumpster divers going in there and pulling them out. And it was just so frustrating. And it, like I said, frustrating a lot tonight. It was so annoying because why wouldn't you just label these and rent them? Why would you throw them out?
Because we're going to talk about porno in a little bit and how that helped shape the video store. You want to talk stigma, the porno movies, but Curse of the Cannibal Confederates and things like that had the stigma of sleaze. And when you're a clean store like a Blockbuster, you don't want a Cannibal Holocaust. You don't want a movie like Fulci's Zombie in there. They don't fit.
Yeah, I mean, it can be a big problem a lot of the time. Like you said, the corporations moving in on the video stores is a lot like, you know, Starbucks. It's just kind of a watered-down version of something that the general public actually enjoys, like with mom-and-pop video stores selling a lot of the more sort of oddball movies that we all enjoy. And then you got the corporations coming in with their watered-down, edited, very badly edited versions, bad prints of movies. And it really does, it can really mess with the smaller chains, the mom and pop stores, the smaller video stores, because ultimately my favorite video stores were always the sort of more independently run ones. I would always find myself going to Videomatica a hell of a lot more often than Blockbuster, because I would find a lot more movies. I would find a much bigger selection rather than just simply the whatever's popular at the time or whatever's
Blockbuster didn't speak to you. Videomatica did.
That's right.
Now we got to talk about porno was such a big deal. Now, keep in mind, I said buying like a Wizard video or a Magnetic video or Mita or something would be $80 in you know their contemporary money. Porno, on the other hand, might be as much as $120. So pornos were much harder to get. To be able to rent a porno and jack off in your own house and watch the scene again, this is something you could only have dreamt about. These were never going to play on TV. I mean, yeah, you had like, you know, the Spice Channel and American Triple Ecstasy in the later 80s, but these were never going to play on TV. And now you didn't have to go to that sleazy part of town where the floors were sticky and it wasn't from soda residue. Now you could jack off in your own home. It is estimated that porno made up 78% of all video rentals between 1982 and 1984. Keep in mind how many mainstream movies were out at that point on video, or even like stuff like Wizard. 78% of their business being porno. That says something, doesn't it?
Yeah, there was almost a when HD DVD and Blu-ray were coming out and the format wars were going at that. Blu-ray said they don't want porn and HD DVD got all the porn. So that was pretty much like right there. That was like, uh-oh, Blu-ray is going to die. And then they panicked. And there was a few other things that happened, but long story short, I think they got Warner Brothers to sign on, and then some other company signed on to Blu-ray, and then that ended up putting HD DVD out of business.
The exact same opposite thing happened in the 80s with VHS versus Betamax when it came to porn, though. Beta would not, because Beta was made exclusively by Sony, and Sony said no porn. VHS said porn. VHS started selling six times as many players as Beta. If Beta had taken porn, that might have been the standard format throughout the 90s.
Yeah. No, the thing was with HD DVD, the only reason why is because everything happened so quickly. They were like, HD DVD announced, hey, we're going to do porn. And they were like, okay. And everything started shifting. And then Blu-ray, like they needed, like Sony didn't want to lose another format war. They lost every single format war they ever were in.
They learned from the Beta mistakes.
They learned from the Beta mistakes. They learned from mini DVD, or not mini DVD, mini disc. They learned so many. And then finally they just said, all right, look, who do we have to pay off? And they paid off all the right companies, and then everything swung back to them. So Blu-ray was the first time they ever won a format war.
I can definitely believe that. I mean, people want to jerk off in the comfort of their own homes. And I think it's really as simple as that. It's it kind of takes away the shame of, I guess, if there is shame of going to a porno theater and, you know, jerking off in an auditorium full of dudes. Maybe you're into that, but a lot of people just want to do it. You know, a lot of people want to just sit on their couch and beat their meat. And, a lot of people don't want people to know that they jerk off. So this is kind of it's an uplifting feeling to know that you just have it there in the comfort of your own home. So I can definitely see how that would be such a big sale, because human beings are perverts, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
42nd Street Pete has the great joke. There were only two great people ever shot in the head in a movie theater: Abraham Lincoln and the guy sitting in front of Pee Wee Herman. Was your video store one of those ones that was curated by people like Quentin Tarantino or Kevin Smith, who were very open about how when they worked in the video store, they knew these movies? They would recommend movies to people. One of the great things about the non-corporate video stores was you could go in and you'd talk to somebody. I mean, he was nobody at the time, but like a Quentin Tarantino. This would be the guy that knows everything. He knows you liked this one movie and you liked the way it looked. He knows that cinematographer also did these movies. This is the guy that's going to recommend a Margaretti movie to you. This is the guy who's going to know all the minutiae, and he's going to know your style and what you're into. People like Tarantino and Kevin Smith were that clerk. Did you guys have those kind of clerks there that you would go to and ask advice, like, hey, I really liked Q the Winged Serpent. Do you have anything else by Larry Cohen? Or did you just have the horror sections over there?
I found them to be, they'd be very helpful. Like I would ask them if I had just watched a trauma movie or a Fulci flick. At least the ones in Videomatica were always very helpful, because I found with the more independent mom and pop style or just indie video stores, those ones really, they gave a shit. Whereas going to Blockbuster, they don't. That's really more of the, you know, horror sections over there kind of thing. As far as like memorable video store experiences, it's kind of the opposite when it comes to the whole, you know, having a Tarantino clerk that guides you and, you know, tells you all about this or that or this filmmaker or this cinematographer. In my case, I had been renting Guyver 2 Dark Hero a lot when I had discovered it on TV. I needed to see it again and again. And I had a video store down the street that carried it. So I would rent it pretty much every week. That was maybe one of my most watched movies when I was about 12 or 13 years old. I remember recommending it to the video store clerk because they had remembered me by this point, because I had rented it like maybe two or three times, maybe four by then. They were like, would you recommend this movie, man? It's like, you seem to watch it a lot. I'm like, dude, it's the fucking best action martial arts movie I've ever seen. It's got so much blood and it's got monsters and shit. And I ended up, he ended up really digging it too. Like when I...
You converted him.
I converted him. I showed him the greatness of Steve Wang and Screaming Mad George and pre-Solid Snake David Hayter. And easily one of the best live action comic book movies ever made. So I felt pretty... I still feel to this day pretty happy about that I was able to convert somebody to that movie, because I always like introducing people to that flick and flicks like it. So I guess I had kind of an experience like that, but ended up being the one influencing the clerk and not the other way around.
The video store that I used to frequent, you know, the mom and pop store, there was a girl who I was friends with that worked there, and she was sweet, but like she really was just working there as a job. Like it wasn't she didn't really care much about movies. Very cool, and would always let me know, you know, hey, you know, you really like these awful full moon movies. Well, there's a new, you know, there's Sea People is out, you know. Oh, yeah. You know, I'd be all excited. For the most part, like the majority of the time I would go in there and I would know way more than her. And it was usually either her or like the owner was working there. So he was cool. But like, you know, he would, you know, oh, why don't you, you know, rent some Clint Eastwood movies or something. And I'd go in there and just get, you know, the Guyver 2 or something, some, you know, some movie that the one thing that was funny, though, that he used to do with me. If I went in and she wasn't working and he was, he would be like, hey, there's this movie that everybody is saying is the worst movie they've ever seen. Do you want it? And I'm like, yes. So he would pull whatever, you know, hey, I had all these people coming in complaining that this movie was terrible. Do you want to see it? Now, I of course I want to see it. What is so this?
Are you saying you were that guy?
I guess I was that guy or that kid or whatever you want to say. You know, they would the thing I remember that one in particular because there was the movie The Tall Man with Jeff Goldblum, and he had said he got so many people complaining that this was the worst movie they ever seen. He wanted to kind of run it by a quote unquote expert. So I watched it. And
so are you saying Good Bad Flicks started way earlier?
Yeah, Good Bad Flicks started, you know, way back. This isn't really, you know, as bad as everyone's making it out to be. Now, the tall guy or the tall man or the tall guy, I don't remember which one it was. I remember that being pretty bad, but still not the worst thing I had ever seen. So I brought it back and I'm like, you know, this isn't really all that bad. And then I would go and rent, you know, whatever else was out at the time. And I always would end up leaving there because they had like that was back in the day when you could rent things for multiple days.
You'd get so, 7 days for a buck for a catalog title.
Yeah. So I would go in and, you know, I'd leave with like 3-4 movies. But then, you know, with my insomnia kicking in, you know, I'd watch 3 or 4 movies in an evening and come back the next night and be like, what do you got? And then, you know, go to school that day and, you know, not have done any of my homework because I was up all night watching movies.
One of the ones I remember is, we had a place, it was called Crown Cable. The cable company where you'd go to make your cable payments and get installs was also the video store. And it was a full-service video store, not one of them little half-assed ones. I remember I'd been reading for months in Fangoria. Fangoria had been pushing Hardware by Richard Stanley. They had been pushing that, you know, it had a limited theatrical release, didn't come anywhere near me. I'm in a small town. And I remember they were announcing Hardware was coming out on home video. I remember I was maybe 14, so I couldn't drive yet, so I'm 14 or 15 at this time, and I'm going down there every week. Is Hardware coming out? And, you know, it's in the catalog and whatnot, and they got posters up. I remember actually going there at 8 a.m. in the morning when they opened, and the shipment hadn't come in yet. Clerks knew I was going to ask if Hardware is out yet, and so as soon as they opened the box, they handed me the fresh, still-in-shrink-wrap copy. And I remember that they knew, this is the kid, this teenager. This long-haired teenager in a trench coat wearing an Iron Maiden t-shirt. This is the guy who comes in for all of these movies. And then I would rent Creepers, since that was the American VHS of it, Creepers and Cue the Winged Serpent and Jazz we talked about last week. I think that was the same summer I rented both Sleepaway Camp sequels, 2 and 3 and whatnot, because of the deceptive covers. I was the weird guy. The clerks got to know me. As soon as I came in, they'd be like, we just, like, almost with Cecil, we got these really terrible-looking movies in. Do you want them? Yes. People don't understand what it's like with Netflix and whatnot. Even like when Blockbuster was reigning champion in the late 80s, the clerks there, at least in my experience, didn't give a shit. It's different when you have a clerk that knows your tastes. Tarantino has a story in Lost, I Lost It at the Video Store, about how he'd be able to tell if somebody liked a certain actor or whatnot, if they started an exploitation, he wouldn't just throw them into exploitation. He said he had a lady that came in and was like, she just discovered Tom Hanks. You know, he was still on the rise at the time, so it's not as weird that didn't know who Tom Hanks was. And she asked about, you know, any more Tom Hanks movies. And he was thinking, well, I'm not going to throw her into Bachelor Party or anything like that. So he recommended Nothing in Common with Jackie Gleason as sort of a transition from, now if she likes Nothing in Common, now I'll recommend Bachelor Party to her. Mm-hmm. And he said she came in and he did that and she loved it. That's the kind of experience you do not get on also recommended on Netflix. You don't get that kind of curation. And I think the modern audience doesn't quite understand that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just the way that things have gone. I mean, there are recommendations from people who you follow, and you kind of it's working with that with everything. They have the Steam curators for video games. You have the recommendations through Netflix, and then you have people like myself who you enjoy them, and you'll go and watch their video, and hey, this person just recommended that these movies are playing on Netflix, or that this movie is now available, or this movie's in theaters and you should check it out. So it's kind of it's a different variety of that. It doesn't exactly, I mean, it does replace it, but it kind of sucks that you know, you're not getting that personal touch anymore. But I mean, that's kind of the world that we live in now. People aren't as personable as they used to. And honestly, if we still had a lot of video stores, you would go there and you'd get a bunch of minimum wage kids who are working there who don't really care. It's not like when we were younger, where you had people that worked at video stores because they wanted to go on and like make movies. It's now it's just another place where they can go and work and maybe get some free movies or get some like movie swag out of it.
It's pretty obvious the video store isn't anywhere near as prominent as it used to be, what with all of them dying out. There's no such thing as Blockbuster anymore. This Rogers has turned into a cell phone distribution thing. There are still little ones scattered around here and there, luckily in my city, which I'm very happy about. But it's not like it used to be. And yeah, the Netflix queue thing doesn't work for shit. It just recommends random stuff. If like an actor is in something you watch, it'll recommend something, or if it's something mildly similar to the genre, or sometimes even just something completely random. You're watching Platoon and it suggests Gone with the Wind for some reason. And it's like, you might enjoy this. No,
because
not...
they both won Oscars.
Yeah, pretty much. It's like if you watched a movie that was an Oscar winner, it'll recommend another Oscar winner, even though those movies are nothing like one another. So it doesn't have that personal touch. I'd like to, I guess with nowadays, with the sort of the video store clerks of yesteryear that would recommend things, you're going to kind of find that personal touch now, as Cecil was saying, with people maybe that do the sort of videos we make. I know that I've had a lot of experiences where people have messaged me personally to thank me for introducing them to a movie through my show, and I get a lot of comments like that. People going, "Whoa, I've never heard of this. I can't wait to sit down and watch it after watching your video." And it's like, I guess that's kind of one of the equivalents nowadays of what we used to have with the video store. Is you've got passionate sort of self-producing people that are making shows like that and being passionate about the things they love and introducing people to them, which in a way is kind of like going to a video store and browsing, maybe watching like a goofy little internet video, is sort of like, you know, walking through a video store and seeing some cool covers and chatting up with the clerk about whether to watch it or not. It's definitely more personable than an average night on Netflix. I rarely, if ever, use Netflix. Most of the movies I find out about are just either having discussions with people or going off and browsing like retro movie poster sites and stuff like that. Like, that's how I like finding movies, because it reminds me of walking through a video store and seeing a cool cover and going, hey, I want to see that.
And also knowing that that cover probably is lying to your ass about the movie, too.
Oh, yeah, of course. But you still want to see it anyway, just to see if it lives up to the movie. And when the movie does live up to the poster, that's like, it's even better. And then you go off and you think, hey, you know, this director made this and this actor was in that. Maybe I can find more from this dude. Hey, this one's got a cool poster, too. And the last one didn't lie, so maybe this one won't either. Internet culture of people watching reviews and videos like ours, like Cecil's, like mine, like yours, and some of the other people that we know, like Brad is an excellent show to watch, because I know that in his show he's ragging on the film, but he genuinely loves a lot of that stuff. And I know that I've discovered certain films through his show, and I know a lot of his fans have as well. So through that medium, it's almost like a sort of a video store experience, because you're witnessing this very passionate person going on about and discussing this movie, and you see little clips from it, and you kind of go, well, this might be something I would enjoy watching. And it's that's kind of one of the closest things to having that personable video store experience that we all miss so much.
Well, and then also, as the video stores are just becoming super huge by the mid-90s, Blockbuster is squashing some of the smaller ones, but there's still a lot around. You started to find that the movies being made exclusively for the DirecTV market are not the low-budget trash that would have been drive-in movies, you know, a few years earlier, like we were talking prior. Now you're finding direct-to-video films that have $10 million budgets and casts of maybe not A-list, but definite B-list stars, like 1995's Body Count. Movie had a $5 million budget. It stars Robert Davi, Stephen Bauer, Bridget Nielsen, Sonny Chiba, and Jan Michael Vincent, and it's an amazing crime thriller. And you go, well, nobody's heard of this film because it was direct-to-video. Direct-to-video was not always where low-budget trash wound up. Like today, if a movie goes direct-to-video, it's probably low-budget trash. That wasn't always the case, was it? I mean, direct-to-video was a place where you could get... I don't think any of the Warlock sequels were theatrical. I swear they at least look like they had the same budget as the first film. The later, the mid-90s direct-to-video became a higher-end drive-in version, a higher-end version of the drive-in movies that the studios didn't want to think of. Because Warner Brothers, Paramount, Universal, they're not making direct-to-video movies. They're making theatrical films. IVE and Media Home Entertainment and whatnot, they're making DTV movies. Didn't always mean trash.
Actually, I kind of go in the opposite. There's like now there are a lot of movies that are going direct to video that aren't trash. I think that the stigma has kind of stuck with it that direct to video movies are trash. But there are so many good movies. Trick or Treat went straight to video, and that's because the studio had no idea what they were doing.
Right, but that was made to be a theatrical release. Trick or Treat is a different, when you know the behind the scenes, that was made for theatrical distribution. That's not really a direct-to-video movie. It just won't. Okay, that would be like saying Theodore Rex was a direct-to-video film. That was a $37 million theatrical film that no one wanted, so it was just dumped on video. That's different than something made for video, like Body Count.
But there are a lot of movies that, okay, so that one, but there's a lot of movies that are made for direct-to-video. There was a movie I just saw not that long ago, The Final Girls, that was really good. And that one was made specifically for video. And for some reason, they made it PG-13 and undercut it, but that's beside the point. But there are a lot of very good movies that are coming out on home video anymore. Or they're opening in like two theaters and then they're going to video. So like Deathgasm.
Like what I was thinking about, Cecil, was how by the, and I do agree with you. There has been a shift back to like what the mid-90s direct-to-video was. But from about 97 to about maybe 2010, direct-to-video meant crap. It meant Asylum movies. This is before they were making the Mockbusters, because I've got a couple Asylum VHSs from the early 2000s, and they were actual movies. You know, that was the Asylum movies and stuff that would now be Sci-Fi Channel Saturday Night stuff. That's what direct-to-video meant for a good 15-year gap there. But I do agree with you. It is kind of swung back. John dies at the end. It was made theatrically, and it was only released in like 100 theaters. I'd say 90% of us saw that on video.
Mm-hmm.
So John mm-hmm. Dies at the End is essentially a DTV title, although it has the Trick or Treat exception of being made theatrically. Am I just splitting hairs, or do you see what I'm talking about?
I don't know. I think that there is a valid point there, but it's also it's kind of a timing thing. I don't think that direct-to-video is quite as frowned upon, especially now when you have so many people that just aren't going to the theater and are just watching stuff on Netflix. They have no idea if something was released theatrically. They just see something, hey, this just popped up on my Netflix queue and it looks cool, so I'm going to watch it.
With direct-to-video, it has its transitional periods, I guess, because late 80s to early 90s had a really great direct-to-video time of some really solid action movies, some nice lesser-known horror movies, and then, of course, yeah, the
Full Moon stuff defined direct-to-video late 80s, early 90s in the best way.
Exactly. We had there was some really great stuff there, and then some of the more Asylum-type titles showed up, you know, the Shark Attack movies and stuff like that. But I think now it's sort of transitioning more to where some DTV titles can be better than a lot of theatrical releases. I mean, right now it's an incredible platform for lesser-known action stars to take the stage. Like Scott Adkins is one of the most amazing action stars nowadays, and who else? Like, it's a great place to see like Michael Jai White in some good movies.
Jesus, Jean-Claude Van Damme made his best movies in his DTV era. The exact opposite of what Seagal did, where he made his worst movies in the DTV era.
I think with the whole direct-to-video thing, it's especially, as Cecil said, with Netflix, a lot more people are just watching stuff at home and through streaming. But I think not only that, but there are a lot of independent filmmakers and independent actors that are more enjoyable to watch than a lot of the blockbuster mainstream stuff.
So, Cecil, would you say you lost it at the video store as a kid?
No, I did not. It's a very unusual title. No, I did not lose it at the video store. I might have.
You might have bang a chick in a Blockbuster though.
I did we didn't do it. Like, basically, I was seeing a girl that worked at the Blockbuster. She actually kind of picked me up because I was renting Doll Man, and she's like, Doll Man, 13 Inches with an Attitude, and I'm like, I didn't know how to respond to that, because that was the tagline for the movie. And then we kind of hit it off from there. And then next thing you know, a month later, we're fooling around the back room. But so no, I did not lose it at a Blockbuster, but I did fool around in a Blockbuster.
All right, Peter, where can people find you losing it at the video store?
My mind, losing my mind and gaining experience and knowledge in movies and apparently losing my virginity. I don't know. You can find me losing something, my mind, on Twitter at Cinematica, on Facebook, The Cinemasochist, YouTube, The Cinemasochist, putting out content as often as I possibly can with all this mind losing. And on 1201beyond.com, buy a shirt. I think my shirts are going to be up on there soon. I have no idea. I should really get on Cassandra about that.
Sounded so dirty.
Yes, it did.
Cecil, where can we see your 13 Inches with an Attitude?
You can see my 13 Inches with an Irish Attitude over at the Escapist or EscapistMagazine.com, GoodBadFlicks.com, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places.
You can find me at 1201beyond.com, and I did lose it at the video store. Of all the things I've lost, I missed my mind the most. So 1201beyond.com, contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. Remember the VHS era. Oh, also, I have a column in Fangoria magazine all about the VHS era called VH Yes, the movies you can only see on VHS. Make sure you check that out. Keep one foot in the gutter, one fist in the gold.
Ready? Roll tape, playback, and action. We'll be right back.
Radio Drome is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.